I was kidding Jim. I get the Jim story this morning. Yeah, he used to walk in the, like he was talking yesterday about the school buses.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome everyone to the September work session of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. Is there any member of the audience who wanted to speak under citizens' time to the board? And we'll do a second call when we begin the business meeting, but I want to make sure that if citizens had some time limitations, we could accommodate that. If not, we're going to dive right into the agenda, and I will say I have to go over to the Senate Finance Committee a little before 11 o'clock to brief them on the revenue situation, Commissioner, so I'll be tied up a little bit in that, and hopefully that will go well.
Would you like us to help you with that, Mr. Chairman?
You know, we do meet at the same time, and I think there's an opportunity here that we should not pass up. I'm just not sure when and how to exercise that. In any event, the first item on the agenda is an update on the American Revenue and Reinvestment Act, known as stimulus. Ms. Buescher and Mr. Pittard are going to just give us a quick update on that. Welcome.
Good morning. I'll do the first half of the presentation on the highway projects, and then Mr. Pittard will join me at the podium and talk to you a little bit about public transportation and transit. With regard to the prioritization that we used in the development and selection of projects for the highway portion of the ARRA funding, we obviously wanted to meet all federal requirements, and that had to do with the obligation timing and the spending of the funds and the distribution of the funds across the state. We also, from the Commonwealth perspective, we looked at very specifically structurally deficient bridges, deficient pavements. Several BRAC projects were included in our selection, and we also took a look at the canceled or delayed highway and rail projects from the reduction to the six-year program that we've been through over the last year and a half. And the citizen suggestions that came in into the governor's website. Just as a refresher, we had to talk and consult with many different groups for the transparency part of this process. We had citizen recommendations we reviewed. We had to communicate with USDOT, FHWA. We communicate with the congressional delegation, several committees of the General Assembly. We worked very closely with the metropolitan planning organizations and localities and advocacy groups. To get into the summary of where we are in the highway projects, VDOT received $694.5 million in ARRA funding in total. Of that, $576.7 million was to be allocated by the Commonwealth Transportation Board. The remaining $117.8 million was actually allocated to the five large MPOs. To date, the CTB has approved $669.8 million in candidate projects for ARRA funds. As you know, we over-selected, if you will, and created some contingency paving and construction projects. As we've indicated to you, as we've brought projects forward for contract approval, we've been getting very good prices on our advertised projects, and so we've had some savings to date. So we wanted to make sure we had in place projects where we could use those savings as more of them go to add and award. This slide's very busy, but it just shows you in summary by the project categories that we had $20.8 million in enhancement projects, almost $100 million in BRAC projects, bridges, $115.9 million, deficient pavements, about $132 million, rail projects, $63 million in this component of the highway projects, and some congestion relief project's $124 million, and then some of the additional paving and congestion relief construction projects. 74 highway projects have been approved. 47 of those have been obligated to date for about $306 million. Of those, 39 have been advertised for a total value of $337 million. And of those, 22 have been awarded to date. And they're on your agenda today or this afternoon, you will consider awarding the contract for the Fort Eustis project. Again, that had an estimated value of $27 million, and Byron will tell you this afternoon the good news that that has also come in under estimate. At the October meeting, we hope to bring to you some of the design-build bridge projects and two of the congestion projects for award, so about $90 million hopefully in October. And then on forward, we have some in November, December, January, February, March. To date, as I mentioned, of the awarded contracts, we've had $16.8 million in savings from the actual award prices versus the estimates. And so we went ahead and we advertised five of the contingent paving projects for $14.9 million to make sure we had the amount that we felt was appropriate for paving in total. Now, what you'll see this afternoon on your action agenda will be the projects submitted by the MPOs that we'll be recommending for you to add to this 10 through 15 six-year program so that we can move those forward for certification and authorization through the FHWA. Of the $117.8 million, that amount was sub-allocated to Richmond, Tri-Cities, Fredericksburg, Nova, and Hampton Roads. We've worked extremely closely, central office and district staff, with the MPOs to identify projects that meet the requirements and the goals of the ARRA funding. And if you approve those as additions to the program today, we will continue to work with the MPOs to get those certified, obligated, and open to charges. All five of the MPOs have submitted their projects, and they have until March 2nd of 2010 to get those obligated. Now, the caveat here, and this is one of the federal government's rules, is if they don't get their funds obligated by March 2nd, those funds are withdrawn and then redistributed to other states at some appropriate time. But we don't anticipate that at all. We have all the projects on the table. You approve them today, we'll get them certified, and we'll move forward. The Richmond MPO was sub-allocated $20.8 million. They've identified three projects for ARRA funding. There's a project on Route 10 in Chesterfield, Route 250 in Goochland, and Route 95 in Hanover. You may have seen a little bit of a press release related to those projects in the last week or so. We are going to recommend to you to approve those this afternoon. Next is Tri-Cities. They received $3.3 million allocation. They've identified two projects for funding. They have identified some resurfacing of various routes in all three of the localities in the Tri-Cities MPO for about $2.6 million. And another additional paving and resurfacing project in Colonial Heights at $0.7 million. And we do recommend those. Fredericksburg MPO had $1.4 million sub-allocated. They have identified one project, the rest area interchange and toll road, at approximately $1.4 million. At this time, that's under study, and before they can finalize this project, they need to finish the study and look at the viability of that project. Northern Virginia had $51.3 million sub-allocated. They've identified 20 projects. I know the audience cannot see this list. They can on their handout. If you don't mind, rather than me reading them, that you can review the list. And if you have any questions, please feel free to ask. Hampton Roads had $41 million. They've identified 29 projects. And we actually have been able to get those certified, most of those certified by the governor to date, but they can't move forward without your approval and adoption into the six-year program. And we hope to go with the rest of them in terms of certification by the end of the month. And here are the seven additional that we'll certify shortly. There is one locality that we're working with in Hampton Roads, and the district is, in resolving some issues with regard to their four small projects. Okay, I will turn it over to Mr. Pittard at this point.
Mr. Chair, I do have one question. Ms. Busher, on, I think it was maybe like your third slide, you had VDOT received $694.5 million. With $576.7 million allocated. When we make the allocations today, is that the difference between those two?
The $117 million sub-allocated to the MPOs is the difference between the 694 and the 576.
Thank you, Rita. I'm going to give a brief update on the rail and transit ARRA funding and where we're at with those programs and where we're going to be going the next couple of months. First, we'll start with the rail program. On August 24th, we submitted a Track 1 application for $75 million for an 11-mile section in the I-95 corridor from Arkandale to Powell's Creek. Hopefully, we'll be receiving word. Tentatively, the FRA came out and said 60 days, which would put us mid-October decision. We're not sure if that will be met or not, but hopefully by the end of this year, certainly we'll hear something back on that application. Additionally, and even the larger sum that we're seeking under the ARRA high-speed rail funds, we're putting together a $1.7 billion application. Once again, for the I-95 corridor from Petersburg to Richmond. That is due to FRA on October 2nd. Once again, decisions tentatively were scheduled for December. Reality, we're expecting later spring of 10, maybe potentially even later than that. Additionally, we also plan to submit a Track 2, Round 2. There's a second round for Track 2 applications. For the improvements between Hampton Roads and Richmond. And the holdup there is currently there is a draft environmental impact statement that we need a record of decision from FRA. And we expect that by the time the application period for the Track 2 Round 2 comes around in spring that that decision will be made. Additionally, with respect to rail, we did receive $10 million of highway funding that is to be utilized in the ACA Yard final design, and that has been awarded, I think as of maybe 3 weeks ago it was awarded. Just to differentiate before we leave here, Track 1 applications are construction-ready projects. Track 2 are projects that still have some engineering and design work to be done. This is a graphical depiction of the $1.7 billion. As I said, it stretches from Petersburg from Petersburg through Richmond on to Washington. And if you add up the number of miles here, that whole corridor is 126 miles. If you add the miles up, it's 111 where actual work will be done. I'm not going to read through each section. This is a good overview of the entire project broken down into segments. This is a graphical depiction of the Hampton Roads the Hampton Roads high-speed rail corridor, and it depicts the two alignments that are currently under study. So there's a northern alignment and a southern alignment. This is what my preferred alternative, a record of decision of FRA, will need to be authorized before we can actually apply for these funds. Next, I want to talk a little bit about transit. You know, with transit, we have our large urban grantees that receive direct funding. We are recording, reporting on those funds and tracking them. However, the actual applications with the FDA are going through those entities. This list provides you some relevant numbers of what actually each entity, the larger entities, received in the state of Virginia, and gives you a little bit idea of what their intended purpose for the funds are. A lot of buses and facility work, and then with VRE, once again, their number one priority right now is locomotives. Other items of interest in the transit update. We had a September 1 obligation deadline, which we met. Basically, we had $30.5 million that was allocated to the state of Virginia to oversee with respect to the small urban and rural grantees. We came to you in April with a list of proposed grants, allocations from that funding of approximately $17.5 million. And we've met our September 1 deadline and received awards from the FTA for those projects. In addition to that, that leaves about $14 million of that funding left. We had a second application period, which closed on Monday, the 14th, and we received approximately $28 million in applications, which we're going through today as we speak. And then we're looking to come back to you in October with a recommended set of projects, and then look for a November approval of those projects. Additionally, with respect to transit, the Federal Supplemental Appropriations Act of 2009 allowed 10% of the ARRA transit capital funds to, for lack of a better word, to be flexed from capital to operating assistance to offset reductions in revenues throughout the country. Chip Badger later is going to be talking a little bit more in detail about this, but we're going to request that we be allowed to do that flex of the 10% of the $31 million, so $3.1 million we would like to move from capital into operating to support our small urban and rural operations for transit providers. And then just finally, just a little bit of where we are with the funding. You can see numerous of our small urban providers have performed procurements, in the middle of procurements, and actually have made awards. In addition to this, it's not on the slide, but our largest rural provider, Virginia Transit, they have actually, under a letter of no prejudice from us, they have actually moved forward, and they have actually made awards for purchase of buses also. So, things moving a little bit slower as far as actually turning dirt might be concerned, but procurements are underway with these funds. So, I know the bus companies, typically we're looking at 18-month turnaround to build a bus, but a lot of the bus companies ramped up so that they could turn the buses out faster. And a lot of people jumped in early to get their orders in also. And that concludes our presentation. If you have questions, be happy to entertain them.
Okay. Before we go to questions, Ms. Badger, did you want to add something?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me. I thought maybe this would be a good time to further explain what's going on with the ARRA reallocation that Mr. Pitter just mentioned. A couple items down on the agenda here, you're going to hear about revenue reductions. And revenue reductions have hit DRPT just as they're hitting VDOT. And they are going to hit in fiscal year 10 as well as every year through the next 5 years of the six-year program. This will have an impact on our state operating grants and our state capital grants. We're particularly concerned about the impact on operating. You know, our transit systems have been operating their fiscal year 10 budgets since July 1st, and operating under the assumption that they were going to get a certain amount of state aid from DRPT, and it looks like now that we will not have sufficient money to honor all those grants. So we are going to do everything we can to minimize the reductions to our transit systems of their state operating grants. One of the things we can do is to use some of these ARRA funds for operating. Now, I had previously sent you all an email telling you that I didn't think that was a good idea, but that was before I knew we were losing state money. What we're trying to do is to backfill with ARRA funds, to the extent that we can, our loss in state funds. There will still be some reduction, certainly on the capital side, and for our large urban systems, there will still be a reduction. But what I'm asking today is for you to let us use those ARRA funds to minimize the impact on transit operating budgets. I'd be happy to answer any questions on that. We will be bringing you a revised program in November that will show you exactly what had to be done to every grant. And this resolution would give us the flexibility to try to minimize the impacts on operating budgets.
And just, again, to be clear, this is the flexibility is only for the rural and the small urban providers.
That's correct.
The larger transit properties don't have that flexibility. It's just a quirk of the stimulus.
You saw in a previous slide, some of them did get ARRA funds that they programmed for capital. I'm not sure they may or may not be able to reprogram some of those for operating. I don't know what their individual situations are, but they have the option, like the state does, of using up to 10%.
That's in their individual discretion. Ms. Pandek and then Mr. Coulombe.
The sort of net out of how much is preserved in terms of operating funding. Are you going to give that today, or are we going to get that in October, both for the rural and for the more urbanized transit?
The resolution that you have today shows a tentative allocation of ARRA funds for each of the rural and small urban areas. I'm hoping when we go back and do the math and work with FTA, we'll be able to avoid the rural and small urban seeing a net reduction. We hope to be able to replace all the lost state funds with federal funds so they would not see a net amount of support from the federal and state government combined. We're going to have to do individual math on every grant, so I won't know yet how much of that savings will spill over to the large urban, but some of it will. So when we do that, we'll have a good number for you. But we're going to do whatever we can to minimize the reductions in all our grants.
Ms. Coulombe?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Badger, do you have to request the ability to shift funds from capital operating, or simply report that you're doing it?
Well, since the CTB approves our allocation of federal funds, as you did back in June, we're asking you to approve the allocation of these ARRA funds. And I'm asking you to do that today because we need to move very quickly on getting these funds programmed. FTA can make new grants up to the 25th of September, and then they shut down because of the new federal fiscal year. And we want to have these grants in place so that we can start getting the money flowing.
Agenda item today is a grant of administrative authority for the director to work with the individual properties and find the proper balance between capital and operating.
Just a point of clarification. On the grants that we make normally to these rural providers, they're not really grants, then. They're allocations that can be withdrawn at any point?
Unfortunately, yes. All our grants are subject to revenues being available. We've had to do this twice now. We had to do it last year, mid-year adjustment to all our operating grants, and we had to do it again this year, and it's very unfortunate.
Mr. Lane?
Mr. Pittard, I had a question for you in regards to the Hampton Roads High School rate order. Mm-hmm. You made a comment that the preferred alternative has to be authorized before application, preferred high-speed designation.
Yeah, I'll jump in here. Okay. Yes, we have a draft environmental impact statement prepared. It's being reviewed by the Federal Railroad Administration. It'll come out very soon, I hope. We'll receive public comment, and we'll come to this board with a recommendation on a preferred alternative. Then we'll package this up and ship it back to FRA to get a record of decision. That will need to be in their hands. The recommendation for a preferred alternative has to be in their hands before we can submit the application. We don't have to wait for the record of decision. We don't have to wait for them to decide. So long as the ball is in their court, we can submit our round two application.
And even though we just designate one route over the other, the funds could be available for enhancements to both.
That's true. One of the alternatives is to do high speed on the Peninsula Corridor and then regular speed, 79-mile-an-hour speed service on the south side. So that is one of the alternatives.
Let me be very clear. This is a sensitive topic. Even though the environmental document has, I believe, six alternatives, this body is not bound by those. This body, after the public hearings and the public input, there's a possibility of a hybrid. So, and again, for and I know Mr. Dickens and Mr. Lane have been involved in this. This has been cast as a false dichotomy, in my judgment, in the Hampton Roads region. And this body will make the final recommendation to the Federal Railroad Administration, of course, based on the recommendation of the department.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other, Mr. White?
Chip, just so I'm clear, the requested transfer of the stimulus funding to operating, as I understand you, that's only going to solve the problem for fiscal 2010. And so these transit operations will still be facing the operating fund deficit in 2011.
That's a very important point. You're exactly right. The projections for 2011 show that operating grants in 2011 will be about 9% less than the grants you awarded for 2010 in June. So they are looking at about a 9% reduction next year over the grants they were told they would have in June. Now, we are going to be cutting those, but they need to be aware of that and making plans.
Mr. Chairman? I think Mr. White makes an important point, and I really am very excited about the opportunity to launch high-speed rail and what that means both economically and moving people around. And on the BRAC projects, particularly in Northern Virginia, we've almost been freaked by the possibilities of even having the new military personnel being stuck in traffic trying to get their offices. So that's exciting. But I hope, and I'm really glad we can get the rest of this money, but I really hope that there's not this illusion that there's no longer a transportation financing problem this year, because huge amounts of this money, and I'm not good at numbers, but it seems to me almost $400 million of it, maybe more, are for things that we should be doing as a state to pay for transportation maintenance and capital improvements, but largely even just maintenance stuff. And the congestion relief is horrible in the I-95 corridor. And so I really am pleased that we have this opportunity, but at the same time we'd have a bigger opportunity if we didn't have to fund some of the things that haven't been funded
or
won't be funded.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you, Ms. Buescher, Mr. Pittard. And let me just close out this item while the commissioner is coming up to give us a brief on the blueprint update. The first is that some of you may hear commentary, and this is important, Mr. Coulombe, in particular for you guys. One of the questions may be, well, how fast are these stimulus projects rolling out? And we have made a determination, and this is very important for you all to understand based on yesterday, there are short-term and long-term economic benefits to transportation projects. A paving project has essentially short-term economic benefits, but an interchange, a bridge, a major piece of infrastructure improvement has continuing economic benefits. And so we've tried to strike a balance in this program. There are some states who have put virtually all of their money into paving projects very quickly. And we have tried to strike a balance between the quick hit projects of paving and projects that had been on the shelf, as well as those that have a little bit longer life. And in particular, in Northern Virginia, we did have a joint letter from Congressman Moran, Wolf, and Connolly saying the same thing, is we don't want just to take care of what we have. We have real live growth, congestion relief, and economic benefit issues. So some of you may see and be quizzed back home about, well, gosh, why isn't Virginia the fastest state? And we've chosen a very deliberate course in consultation with our congressional delegation, the Joint Commission on Transportation Accountability, and others. And so you may see some of these stimulus projects rolling out a little more slowly than in other states. But the long-term economic benefit for the Commonwealth will be the beneficiary. Thank you. Commissioner, welcome. We're looking forward to your blueprint update.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was almost going to make a facetious response to that. Looking forward to this update is not high on my priority list. Good morning, everybody. And this I've got a little different label this month on this report. As a part of our monthly report, under the General Assembly Acts of the Appropriation that was passed, I'm required on a quarterly basis to provide a report to the governor and to the chairs of select committees within the General Assembly. So I'm giving you a preview of what I anticipate being able to report at the end of the month as a part of that first quarterly report that's due. So that's why you see the different label. Also, I'd like to highlight for you as a kind of a counterpoint here, the quarterly report I put at each of your places this morning, which document for you again the department's and the staff's accomplishment of meeting all its on-time and on-budget and quality performance targets for the last fiscal year, in spite of, and this is the counterpoint, all the work that is going on with the blueprint and the changes that we are going through within the department. The staff, a credit to their professionalism, and I have many anecdotal stories over the last 3 months, as all of these changes are affecting their work lives, their personal lives, have continued to demonstrate clear professionalism and carrying forth the mission and the responsibilities of this department throughout the year. And even though, even as we do things that are required under code, employees are telling us, you don't need to do those things. You don't need to worry. We're here, we're committed, and we are continuing to do our jobs. And so that to me is a real testimony, and it's really captured by this quarterly report. What I'm going to do for you this morning, then, is give you a snapshot of where we are in the transition process. And so I've, in the front end of this, given you some slides that you're all familiar with that are really the front end pieces I use every month just to keep everybody focused on what the mission is and what the charge is. First, the quick five-bullet overview of why we're here in responding to the $2.6 billion that the current blueprint addresses as a response to the downturn in our revenues and the economy. And I won't go through a lot of the highlights on these points other than to remind the third bullet, which is the $2 billion that we've already removed from the program of projects, on top of the $1.1 billion that you removed in June of 2008. And then the $600 million that we're addressing through reductions in services and programs and through reorganization and reduction of the department staff size. And that constant bullet that as we're now learning, those revenue estimates are going to continue to change. This slide I included just so that you have a ready reference around the Appropriations Act language that was enacted this session, which added formality and structure to the blueprint proposal that we had brought forward to the board and had been adopted by the board as a direction. These are the highlights of that piece of legislation, which establishes the targets of 7,500 employee classified employees by June of 2010, and installed the requirement for this comprehensive plan and report that a quarterly reporting. This I included because it sets the scene for the reminder and the constant part of the blueprint. There are three legs to the stool. There are three legs to the blueprint. A continuing focus on the six-year program, our organization and staffing, remodeling of the department. You'll also notice that is administrative and support program, and then our services and maintenance program reductions. I use this one bullet point as a highlight about what VDOT and the business will look like in 2010. We will be smaller. We will be providing our services differently and proportioned differently. It is critical as you think and keep focused on VDOT of 2010 that it is a VDOT that is not just smaller, but it is a VDOT that is proportioned its staff differently. That colors how we go about achieving the reductions in staff that we're currently going through. Here's the highlight overview of what we have accomplished as a part of the first quarterly report as a result of the action plan. I submitted to the board, and all of you should have copies of the comprehensive plan that we submitted July 1st. With the in response to the appropriations language. We have implemented the fiscal year 10 through 15 program and project reductions. We have implemented, and I'll give you a more detailed slide on that shortly, the program reductions in the maintenance and services areas. We have initiated our first realignments of the department as a part of the reproportioning. Those have focused predominantly around realigning our learning center or our educational programs with the research council so that we are able to tie very clearly our research and change programs with our educational programs. We think that that's going to make a significant difference in the speed with which we can deploy research results within the department and within the practice of our business. We've also realigned our local assistance office, and of course, we've implemented the closure of our equipment shops. We've also completed our stage one reductions with wage employees. Those are our temporary employees. That was completed at mid-June, and we have initiated, as I briefed you in July, on the stage two first classified employee reductions with those first notices to about 640 employees within the department. I've included this slide, and I won't spend any time on it because it's one you're all familiar with because it's the decisions you've had to make as we've moved the program from $8.6 billion down to $5.5 currently as the six-year program adoptions that you've implemented. This is the overview then on the services side of the program, our maintenance and operations services. You can see that we have highlighted the 18 service areas, as I characterize them, that the department provides on a daily basis. Those in red are the target, or orange, I guess that's orange, are the targeted services that have been reduced in the 10 through 15 program. I highlight down at the bottom that this was very consciously done under a clear philosophy of preserving emergency response and safety response issues as our first priorities in service. Therefore, as contrary to all the conversation that's gone on, we are driven and we have made no changes in our snow and ice control guidelines. So you can continue to remind, even as we move into this winter, that those services are there and will be provided. The reductions, and I've given this to you on a six-year time frame so that you can see the real magnitude of these permanent reductions that have been implemented as a part of our service mix. Roadside services, that's the base level mowing. That will account for about $120 million in reductions over the next 6 years. our safety service patrols that have been reduced. We now provide service, obviously, only in the Hampton Roads and in the Northern Virginia area. We'll reduce our program about $21 million. Ferry services are operational changes and schedule reductions. Will account for about $7.8 million. Rest area and welcome centers will be about $54 million. And the maintenance reserves reduction, the amount we hold back for emergencies, will account for about $75 million. That in total, if I'm about right, is about $283 million. What I do not show on this slide, because we are still in discussion and negotiation with our TAMS providers, our asset management providers on the interstate system, is the net effect of those reductions, and those will be implemented over the next also 6 years. So I'll be able to report to you on that when we finish contract negotiations with them. Ms. Pandey.
Mr. Chairman, if I might have a question. You refer to these as savings being achieved. These are not efficiency savings, are they?
No, these are pure hard dollar reductions. And I vacillate, and you'll see that in the title, I will tend to use reductions, although our lexicon tries to talk about savings. These are reductions. They are not savings. The third part of the blueprint deals with then the staffing and the organization, and I've already introed that. What I've given you is our baseline and our benchmark from last September when we were at 8,464 classified employees. You see the distribution between our central functions and our field staff in that first column and where we were with wage employees, our temporaries at that point. As of the end of this month, our anticipated, and we think this is a fairly solid number, staffing will be about 7,830. It might be less than that. The numbers are changing daily as we go through the stage two layoff process. That will be proportioned about 1,100, almost about 1,190 in central functions, and about 6,650 in the field. We are down at about 113 wage employees. We have a process in place where we are continuing to review each of those now on almost a monthly basis as their one-year terms come up. And then I've shown in the third column the target for July of 2010 as we had proposed it originally, so that you have a benchmark of the process or the progress we're making in that direction. What I'm showing you, and the only thing I'll focus on, is the status of our stage two involuntary separations as we move through the process now, which began in July. You can see under the stage two what areas of the department are being affected in that stage two transition and the anticipated fiscal year 10 and then the 11 through 14 savings. So you get the sense of that reduction that will occur. In July, I gave you estimated notices that we distributed. This gives you a proportion now in detail of the notices across the board, but both on a geographic area and on a functional basis, so that you can see of the 640 notices provided, this is where they were and by what function within the department. Stage two predominantly focused at our equipment shops and our project delivery development staff. That is what we planned and what you would expect given the downturn in the construction program. This is now some detail as we have gone through the first notice process, and I want to highlight for you how smoothly overall that process has gone. It was well planned. we noticed everyone. We've been preparing the department for the Stage 2 process. It is a cumbersome process, but it is cumbersome by design, and it is insured, and it ensures that our employees have as many opportunities to find openings within the department as possible. Overall, the reaction that I'm hearing at this point is that people are they are surprised at the options that they are being provided as a result. We made it clear that the number of people getting notices, first notice, was not their termination, but rather the beginning of a process, which I tried to outline for the board in July. That process is coming for the Stage 2 employees, is coming to a stage where we will reach finality. In essence, what happened is 640 people got notices. They had a choice to make. Did they want to separate early and not have a placement opportunity, or did they want placement? Of those 640, 272 opted for the September 9th out date, and so they asked not to be placed. Their average experience was about 22 years of service, and that 272 people represented 6,000 years of experience leaving the department. And you'll notice that throughout this, I'm highlighting some things because it's a part of my conclusions. That functional analysis that you see below for those 272 or those people that have opted for the early out give you a sense of where they were by function: Dulles Toll Road, construction, project development, and our equipment shops, and their years of experience in each of those areas. In our major functional groups, professional and engineering, about 1,600 years of experience is leaving with those people in that classification. And in our craft and technical areas, almost 4,000 years of experience. By location, you can see in our functional areas, about 78, if you go back a slide, of the 128 or so in our central functions, 78 in our central functions opted for the September 9th out date. That turns into about 2,000 years of experience. In the field, about 194 people opted for that. That's about 4,000. So it's looking at that same cohort of 272 three or four different ways. I also wanted to highlight, at the same time, in about the 1st of August, we opened an opportunity for employees, which is a feature that has not been used before, which is a substitution process. In other words, we offered the opportunity to employees in the department to identify themselves to be substitutes for any one of those 640 first notices. We had about 685 employees who identified themselves as substitute candidates. That represents about 21,000 years of experience, which is amazing when you think about it. We are in the process now for the about 375 employees who asked to be placed, of going through the process of either matching them to vacancies available in the department or matching them against one of the 685 substitute positions that would be available. That is a very structured process. It is controlled by a special team that I have established within the department so that the matches are legitimate and that there is time then for training, which then turns into the ultimate leave date for the remaining identified people in Stage 2 of about October 24th. I anticipate that will then bring our total to about 517 employees, 520, somewhere in that number, who will have been reduced as a result of the Stage 2 actions. So that's what will affect when I give you the October update, the final outdates, and we'll know exactly who's matched. Today I can't tell you how that process is being finalized because it's occurring next week. What does all this tell you? It tells you that the plan is changing as we move forward. We already have indications that we're going to have to adjust the plan as a result of the latest revenue forecasts. We are still on a track to implement within the 12-month period and hit our completion date of June of 2010. Our functions continue to be examined. I am anticipating that at next month's meeting and no later than November, I'll be able to give the board a good overview of what the final design of the department will look like. As I've indicated to the employees and to the board over time, this is a design-build process, in essence, as we retool VDOT for its future. And the purpose of my previous slide was to prepare you for what you will be feeling over the next 8 to 10 weeks, which is our customers will begin to feel the effects of the experience loss across our business. That could be visited several ways as you experience it and get calls from your friends and neighbors. Might be what happened to my permit. It might be where is this project. Those are all questions that will come that are a result of a loss of experience within the department. I'm told back in the mid-90s, this is a similar experience that occurred when the department radically downsized through a voluntary program. So be prepared for that. What we have protected and what should not be affected radically is our emergency response and maintenance activities provided by the department as we move into the winter months. We have held in place all the tools that our districts and our maintenance operations staff need to be able to manage those events as we move forward throughout the winter. With that, I appreciate the opportunity to give you a brief update. We'll give you more detail, obviously, in October and as we move forward.
Questions, comments? Ms. Kuhlman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Commissioner, first of all, let me thank you. This is the only meeting I get every month where I get to ponder the question, why are we here? So I like that second slide that you have. I had a question about the employment levels. Clearly, you've made much deeper reductions in classified central office functions, slide 9, than in classified field positions. I think it's like 9% in the field and 23% in the central functions. Is that signaling that some of the central functions are actually going to be less central going forward? Is that a part of your strategy, or is that just the way you're trying to keep certain professional functions in place really at the district level?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two observations. First, I counsel everybody, don't try to judge the numbers in the middle of an inning, because you can't do it. Second, you're correct that in our redesign of the department, we are decentralizing and completing a decentralization of a variety of functions that were centrally controlled. My example is if you look at the planning and programming activities, we are in essence strengthening the relationship between Ms. Busher's directorate in programming and planning in the field rather than to do it centrally. That was a move that was initiated in the early 2000s, and we're living that as we move forward. That's causing a redistribution of staff. Conversely, a couple of our functions, particularly in right-of-way, are being probably more centralized than decentralized. Right-of-way and land acquisition, while critical to our business, is not core to the business. It is a very specialized activity. So as we've managed our way through that process, that's why you see right-of-way repositioning itself. We will still have the staff in the field, but they will be more directly managed through a regional concept. So that those cause us efficiencies to meet the goals established in the General Assembly.
Mr. White.
Mr. Commissioner, I have said things like this before, but I want to say them again. I think you're to be commended for the leadership you have shown. This is not any fun. This is tough stuff. And in addition to the operational aspects that you've been talking about, there's the human side of the people that are no longer going to be with the department. And I think you have really shown strong leadership in a very, very difficult environment. And I, for one, want to commend you for the leadership you've demonstrated.
Appreciate that, Mr. White. Thank you.
Mr. Lane.
Thank you. Mr. Commissioner, can you, has our security of facilities been impacted at all by this reduction?
Mr. Chairman, can you help me with security?
There's less people at the facilities. I mean, I'm thinking about the tunnel operations, bridge operations, and access to people coming on and off. And I just was curious, has that been impacted by any way by these reductions?
Mr. Chairman, no. What we're focusing on those activities and stabilizing that. Is it, if you interviewed my staff, would they be comfortable that they have all the human resource that they want? The answer is no. They will clearly tell you if they had more staff, they could do even better than they do. But one of the things I've been impressed with by the senior leadership team is as I set targets and set staffing goals, they are changing process and they are redistributing staff to do the most critical functions first. So, no, we're not sacrificing security and safety.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Commissioner, I'd just like to echo what Mr. White said. And I would say also, too, you mentioned the mid-90s downsizing, which did not have a plan or a goal to get to.
Right.
And what you've done over the last several months and very tough, very hard, day-to-day work that does have a human face on it, you have given us a target to reach. And I know the governor has acknowledged that on several occasions. This is not easy, but it is very, very important work. So thank you,
thank you for
that and your entire team. The next item on the agenda is equally dour. And Rita Buescher is going to give us an update on transportation revenues. Welcome again. And I would preface Ms. Buescher's presentation by saying thank God for the stimulus. it really has cushioned some very, very serious blows. And just Ms. Pandak's comment about that, could you imagine the 8,500 BRAC jobs opening at the Engineer Proving Grounds with only a half-completed Fairfax County Parkway? That would be a traffic jam to behold.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, the first thing I think that I would like to do is take some of the comments that were made by the Department of Taxation in providing background for what's happened to our revenue picture over the last 18 months. Obviously, the U.S. economy itself has deteriorated more than was anticipated in 2009. As a result, we've come back and we've reduced our programs and staffing and our revenue picture. Similar to the nation, the Virginia economy shed more jobs than was expected. The depression in housing continued to adversely affect Virginia's economic performance. The governor, as a result, ordered the Secretary of Finance in mid-June to conduct a reforecast of revenues. So in the August time frame, an interim revenue forecast based on the updated economic outlook for Virginia was produced by the Governor's Advisory Board of Economists and the Governor's Advisory Council on Revenue Estimates. The dedicated state transportation revenues have been greatly impacted by the economy. The estimate for the 2010 motor fuels tax, which is the largest state transportation revenue source, is only slightly at this point above the fiscal year 2003 receipt level. Gasoline consumption is down largely to the high unemployment rates and reduced consumer spending. And most diesel fuel is purchased by motor carriers, which respond to the general economy more than passenger traffic. The second largest state revenue dedicated to transportation is a portion of the retail sales and use tax, also impacted by reduced consumer spending. The fiscal year 10 forecast is comparable to 2006 collections. The motor vehicle sales and use tax has also declined, as we heard yesterday, as car sales slowed. And the 2010 forecast represents a 39% decline from the peak in fiscal year 2005. Due to the depression in housing, the transportation share of the recordation tax for 2010 has dropped 57% from the original estimate in fiscal 2009, which was actually prepared in May of 2007. As you'll recall, this revenue was dedicated to transportation by House Bill 3202, and 2 cents was dedicated to transit operation and 1 cent to the HMOF. The 2010 estimate for the rental tax, 75% of which is dedicated to the rail fund, is less than the amount collected in 2006. So what does this all translate to? The revised revenues given to us in August 2009 show an estimated $883 million reduction from the state revenue sources from the 10 through 15 timeframe. In fiscal year 10, which is what we're looking at now, $155.9 million needs to be reduced from our operating budgets. Now, for VDOT, that's $134.3 million. For DRPT, that's approximately $16 million. The ports and airports are impacted, but at a slightly smaller value for the total of $155. And this chart shows where the reductions are coming from, and the significant amounts are coming from motor vehicle sales and retail sales. In a very quick snapshot, what you will see on this slide is a summary of where we've been. In the spring of 2008, when we were adopting the fiscal year 9 budget in the 9 through 14 original 6-year program, we reduced state revenues by $1.1 billion. We had to go in and revise our revenues in February 2009 by $2.6 million for all of transportation. And now we're at approximately another $0.9 million for a total of $4.6 billion. Now, again, this is over a 6-year time frame. As you'll recall, with the February 9 reductions, of that 2.6, as the commissioner indicated, $2 billion came from the cancellation of highway construction and rail projects. We eliminated all state and federal funds flowing through the primary, secondary, and urban formulas. We reduced maintenance growth to the localities to 3% from 4%. Our goal was to maintain our federal match, which by September 25th, we will have accomplished that for federal fiscal 9. We needed to maintain our funding for transit and rail through the House Bill 3202 bond distribution. But we did realize an 11% reduction in transit operating and capital funding for 2009. For the 6 years, the $883 million breaks down in total $105 million for DRPT, $743 million for VDOT, $22 million for the ports, and $13 million for aviation. This last slide is one that we consistently show when we're looking at the updates and the adoption of our Commonwealth Transportation Fund budget. At the bottom of the page, you'll see the original FY10 revenues for the CTF over the 6 years, 10 through 15, totaling the original $22.8 billion that will drop to $21.97 billion. In 2008 through 2013, that number was $28 billion.
Ms. Keene?
Ms. Boucher, is the $21,977,000 represented what type of an anticipated revenue increase when the budget was prepared? And the total revenue anticipated, did it represent an increase, anticipated planned increase, or was it a decrease?
The $21.9 million for 10 through 15 revised for the latest revenue reductions, John, is that an average of 2-3% increase over time, by year?
I'm sorry, could you clarify the question and the answer?
I think year over year, there is a net change. If you look at 2011, in the revised number that adds up to the 21.9, I believe Mr. Keene is seeing the 3571 grow to 3593 to 3669 to 37. It's a very incremental, very small incremental change. But it's significant if you wanted to look at 2010, 1.9%. Is about the average incrementally year by year.
Let me suggest a simpler way to think about this. If you could go back to slide 6. That's not right. The 6-year forecast that shows the $4.6 billion. Yeah, that's it. You just passed it by. Slide.
Did I pass it?
That one. If you look at what we have done just since last spring is to take $4.6 billion out of the entire transportation budget. That's VDOT, that's DRPT, that's aviation, that's ports, and it is $4.6 billion that's come out. To put that in perspective, the annual total transportation budget for maintenance, operations, VDOT, DRPT, everything is about $4.5 billion. So out of a 6-year budget, both capital and operating, we've lost a year.
Let me put it in perspective for 10. When we did the fiscal 8 through 13 financial plan, fiscal 10 was estimated at $4.6 billion. We are now at $3.6 billion in 10. In 11, it was 4.5. We're at 3.5. 4.6 to 3.6.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Coolman.
Ms. Boucher, on slide 2, where you're updating us on the revenue forecast, what is the scenario there that the state is using? Is it that the recession ends, we continue to lose jobs, recovery is slow, revenues don't begin to pick up until X time, and is there a new forecast of percentage increase or decrease? And the second question is, what I'm trying to get at is how volatile are we looking at, say, the next 6 months in the year, or the next year? Are we going to continue to have our pattern of another set of revisions downward, or are we anticipating a leveling off or even some minor amount of growth?
The recession has not been formally deemed to be at its end. They believe that it is close, as you're seeing some economic, I won't say necessarily improvements, but the slowing of the decline. I think from the state's perspective, and I can't speak for Mr. Lehman in the Department of Taxation, but I believe they're not really going to see an improvement till about 2012 of any significance. That's, I think, why you're seeing a shift of only 1 to 2% overall. We do have another October revenue forecast that they normally do at this time of year as we're developing the 11 through 12 biennial budget to come out in December. I don't know that we won't see, I can't say that we won't see another decline as they continue to adjust. I can't answer your question.
No, I understand. I was just trying to get a feel, Mr. Chairman, of here's the point I'm concluding. Clearly, none of us here could have anticipated the continued slide. I mean, people who are a lot smarter at this than we are, it surprised them as much as anyone else. But I also think it's just as clear as if this body knew at some point in time we were going to have to take a whole year out of the plan, reduce things by $4.6 billion, it would really focus our discussions in a very different way. What I'm trying to see is if we still need to do that. That we need to stop seeing our slow, slippery slide and understand that the bottom of the hole is still here and that we ought to really be thinking about potentially another $2 billion of reductions that we have to make in the future, which would again focus us very differently on what the adjustments we were going to make now. Some things would absolutely just make no sense to even start. So that's what I'm trying to get a feel for. And maybe, obviously, if we could understand that together, it might help give us direction on some of these other issues, too.
I think that's an excellent comment. Part of the most important thing that Ms. Buescher said is there will be another reforecast in October or November. And at that time, it's probably a good idea to see if we can get the state's chief economist, John Lehman, to come talk about this. The thing we have to remember in our business, you can have a recovery of the more robust general fund revenue sources like the consumer sales tax or the income tax. Two-thirds of our revenues are tied to the sale of gasoline and automobiles. And so one could envision a recovery for those general fund resources, which are not projected, by the way, in the current six-year forecast, that did not simultaneously occur with the transportation revenues. Ms. Pandek.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Buescher, it's a little surprising to me that in 13, 14, and 15, we're not seeing larger increases in the sales tax. In fact, it seems to decline again after 2012 if the prediction is that we're recovering. Is there any explanation for that?
I would have to get specifics provided to us from the Department of Taxation. I just think that they very much believe that this recovery is going to be very slow and that the consumers, the job creation and job growth, putting people back to work, is going to be slow, so that there will still be a hesitation on their part to spend in the retail environment. So I think they are taking a conservative stance on retail sales revenue growth.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you, Ms. Buescher, for this exceedingly cheery presentation. We look forward to more. The next item on our agenda is the biennial asset needs report. And Commissioner, I will be leaving out of here about quarter of 11. And maybe that at the conclusion of this, why don't we take a short break as well, and then we'll come back and complete the work session and begin the business session. We do have box lunches, but my hope is we can get out of here in the early afternoon. Welcome, Ms. Sorrell.
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary, members of the board. I'm here to present, I guess, the next chapter of CHEER. Not, unfortunately. If I can see here to bring this up. Here we go. Oh, goodness. The last biennial report, which was also the first one we ever did under a particular section of the Code of Virginia, was back in 2007. And we talked about what the needs were at that time for maintaining and operating the system. And so today, this is the second in what I presume will become a long list of biennial need reports to the governor, the Joint Legislative Audit Commission, and the legislature, and yourselves, in what we think that is needed in order to maintain our system and operate it efficiently. So I'll just start out by just giving you a little overview of what we're going to see today. I want to just touch on the statutory requirements, tell you a little bit about what the framework is, and give you a high-level overview of the methodology, and then give you that good news about what the assessment says, and make a few summary remarks. Hopefully this won't take too long, and there are only about 14 slides, so we should be able to get through them fairly quickly. And so just to give you a brief review, the code has several requirements in it for VDOT to report on the condition of this, the needs. It also sets out some information about what the definition of maintenance and operations are, and asset management also directs the department to use the asset management approach to how we manage and maintain the system, basically life cycle cost and those kinds of things in terms of how to keep assets in good repair over their useful life, those sorts of things. And last but not least, there is a section pertaining to payments to localities that also includes in there some requirements for them to report their expenditures, and they have a couple of measures of performance for local roads, like their bridge sufficiency and also the rideability of their roads. They they're reporting information about the roughness index of their pavements. And so in the appendix or in the end of this particular report, that information that's reported by the localities is there. I'm not going to cover that today other than just to tell you that bridges are at about the same condition, about 8% deficient as our goal is, and their payments for the rideability index for the work that they did seems to be fairly reasonable. As you know, for two counties and the cities of in Virginia, and independent cities and towns, that they do maintain their own roads and they get city street payments for those. So the framework for the maintenance and operations assessment is based on the budgetary framework that you've seen this past June when we adopted the budget. So we basically have two major categories where we talk about asset investments, and those are the hard investments really that relate to rehabilitating pavements, bridges, tunnels, repairing and replacing assets like guardrails, pavement markings, signs, signals, and our ITS technology components. This particular section does not attempt to include the replacement of bridges that need to be replaced. So this really is about maintaining assets through their useful life, but once their useful life expires, such as a bridge, then that really has been funded out of the six-year construction plan. So even though we may talk about what the needs are for the system, some of those needs actually are covered as in terms of what is done in the construction program to replace or rehabilitate pavements and bridges as a part of the construction projects. So services are defined primarily as all those things that you see related to the ordinary maintenance of bridges and traffic, putting up stop signs that have been knocked down, cleaning bridges, cleaning out pipes, any number of things, including our safety service patrols and repairs of minor assets, sidewalks, sound walls. And then the big bucket is snow removal, incident response, which is a very large part of what we do. So all those emergency response activities, whether it's a hurricane or a blizzard or any other kind of weather event. That also includes signal timing, signal optimization, and those kinds of services that relate to traffic signal assets. So, just a very high overview of the methods. In the 2007 report, we probably only had about 62 or 63% of the needs based on some performance standard or service-based model. And so today we have over 80% of the assets covered by these various models, including our pavement management system and various life cycle cost models that we have, or known engineering analysis that has been done that has indicated to us needs for such as the tunnels, for example. In the services area, we have investments related to just cleaning out pipes and basically all the things our staff do on a normal routine with some contracted work out just to keep the system operating. So here's the good news, is that based on the assessment, we need to make investments of approximately $1.1 billion in pavements, bridges, tunnels, traffic and safety-related features, and signals and technology. In the service area, for those five major areas of service, that number is about $782 million for a total of $1,884,500. And the second year, $1,899,000,000. So you look at it, the major increase in this budget over the needs assessment compared to what our 2010 budget is most significantly in this asset investment area. Pavements, the fiscal year budget this year calls for more than $400 million to be spent on pavements, but if we are going to meet our targets in pavements and interstate and primary, as well as maintain the secondary system in the condition it is in today, to keep it from getting any worse, we need to be spending almost $709 million. So these are some very big numbers. There is a detailed report that will be finished shortly that will give you more information about the details of this, how it was calculated. And just in the services area, this slide just gives you a little bit about what those services do include. Emergency and safety service, obviously, incident snow removal. Traffic and safety services, that asset services phrase up there really doesn't describe the things that we're doing there related to signal optimization, paying for all the highway lighting that we have that we keep going, and any number of other kinds of traffic safety services. Rumble strips, for example, are in there. Roadway services, such as just maintaining clean bridges and making sure the scuppers work and things like that. So another $782 million. So the gap, if you want to think about it, a little gap analysis here, this is a $923 million increase over what is proposed for the budgets for traffic, for maintenance and operations in the coming biennium based on the six-year maintenance and operations program budget that was adopted in June. So that's about $475 million in fiscal year 11 and $448 million in fiscal year 12, over and above that.
Mr. White.
Mark.
We've had in my district over the last few months emergency situations with three bridges that had to be dealt with right away. And they were dealt with right away. I don't know what the aggregate cost of that was. Where, what pot does that money come out of? Because these were not anticipated expenditures. They were not in the six-year plan. Is there a special reserve fund to deal with those situations?
Well, we have a small reserve fund that we've referred to as our maintenance, a major infrastructure failure fund. So each quarter, as districts have these kinds of unanticipated failures, there are some funds in the neighborhood of about $25-30 million that is a reserve to help take care of some of those kinds of emergencies.
That's a statewide amount?
Yes. That comes under, that's managed by me and one of the divisions. And so each quarter we proportion it out to the districts based on the major emergency types of services that they've had to do. Well, and so,
given our current situation with bridges and where we stand, what happens if your $30 million runs out during the fiscal year? What fallback position do we have? Or is any of that reflected in these numbers?
I think this is a very significant and serious issue, and one that I think is going to come up when we come back in November to talk about budget reductions. And so in the meantime, today we're okay.
Yeah.
But I think the big message is those contingencies and reserves have been shrinking. And one that we will face as part of a revised budget in November.
Yeah.
As a follow-up to that, have the ongoing cuts been reflected in the needs assessment that, Chairman alluded to earlier? In other words, the ongoing cuts, we're not maintaining this well, it's going to degrade quicker. Have they been reflected in this ongoing needs assessment?
Mr. Secretary, the answer to that is those cuts and reductions in service levels that were reported in the blueprint are projected to stay reduced as a part of this needs assessment. If you were to add that level of service back, it would be approximately another $50 million annually on top of the 923 we've identified here. So another $100 million.
But that's part of the question, but the other part is, has the physical deterioration of the asset been, has these costs impacted that also?
To the extent that we do have pavement models that do have deterioration rates, yes.
You put that in the model.
Yes.
That's what I'm trying to get to.
Yes.
I have a question on the pavement, particularly and the maintenance there. And maybe it's for the commissioner. My question is, how much of that is being done sort of in-house versus using contractors? And with respect to the contracts for maintenance, is when you say routine maintenance, is it automatically done based on the time frame, or is it based on a assessment of the road conditions?
There's a couple of answers to that question. The work that you see going on, for instance, a mill and overlay that you saw in 95 as you were coming south, those are contract projects. We do that by contract. Our staff is focused on the emergency response and key services, which are the pothole repair, which are occurrences that are just a part of doing the business. That's why we show this investment category, which is intended to bring and maintain a pavement to its useful life. And that's a planned investment. Those are all done by contract. We are going through a process in the department where we're fine-tuning, what we do with in-house staff versus what we do by contract. But our direction is that the majority, and I won't put a percentage on it, but the direction is we use the private sector. That in that slide I had where I said our relationship with the private sector is absolutely critical, that's what they're good at, is the production work.
The vast majority of the asset-related work on pavements and bridges is done by the private sector. It's been many years many years since all of the districts had state force construction crews, and we used to be able to do some of these. We've long since lost the capacity to really do much of any of this work, except on an emergency basis.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that, because that has a ripple impact, obviously, with respect to the economy, if there's a reduction there. But my second question is, with respect to that contract work, do the agreements allow the contractor to determine when the maintenance is necessary, or does
no.
the central VDOT management determines that?
We do that just like we would a construction contract, point A to point B, low bid, and complete within a time frame.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Just add every
questions or comments.
To quickly move on, I just would want to point out in this particular slide on number 9, the difference between the 2010 budget and the 2011 budget was that 3% increase that the board adopted for the maintenance and operations program and for city street maintenance payments. So just $50 million from 10 to 11 was just the 3% increase, basically to just cover costs. A small increase in cost that might occur there. So the next slide is just a breakdown by each of the asset areas. So if you look at the first five bars from pavements through signals and ITS technology, that's the asset group. Then the next five bars are the services groups. So you can see, by and large, the increase, this $450 million increase over just next fiscal year, is in getting our pavement conditions back that have deteriorated, and making some particular investments in traffic and safety and technology replacement projects that really are backlogged. So. To move on, the 2009 biennial assessment is approximately 27% higher than the 2007 assessment. And there are many factors for that. These are the top four or five. First, the cost of asphalt and other petroleum-based products increased significantly over this time. Back in 2005, if you had $10 million, you could buy 262 lane miles of paving repair work. In 2008, you could only buy 158 miles. Now, because of the paving prices, have a cost of asphalt has gone down a little bit from the all-time high. What that $10 million today buys 177 lane miles of pavement repair. So it's about a 33% reduction in buying power just over the last 5 years. So the investment needed to meet the pavement targets is $370 million in 2011 and $363 in 2012. This is just for the interstate and primary. The investment needed to maintain the secondary system in its current condition, which is about 31% of the pavement is deficient, needs $338 million next year and $348 million the year after that. This assessment also included needs in the area of maintenance of tunnels and replacement of ITS and other types of technology that really had not been in the 2007 report. And then there have been just updates to the inventory. We think we have our arms around all the major inventories, so that you won't keep seeing us adding more inventory. It'll be mostly just the cost of getting the condition of that inventory to where it needs to be. So we've made some tremendous strides in all these areas. So if you were to invest this additional amount of money with pavements, we would meet interstate pavement targets in 2011. We'd meet the primary pavement targets in 2013, and we would maintain secondary pavements over the biennium. In the bridges, currently we are meeting our performance target to have no more than 8% of bridges be deficient. One caveat to that is the bridge replacement program really is in the construction program. So the money that is in that's identified in this needs assessment is really more along the lines of doing some minor rehab and keeping bridges in pretty good working life to be able to extend their life. But when you start getting into major rehabilitation and replacement of assets because they've outlived their useful life cycle, then that those become construction projects. Sure. So,
does that explain the discrepancy in our budget for bridges?
Yes.
Versus the needs budgeted more than our needs.
Yes. Well, in there's $3.7 billion that's needed to replace all the deficient bridges in the Commonwealth. That's that 8% that's deficient. So, one of the maintenance program, as I understand it, is not meant to rebuild all of those bridges, and that is money that should be coming from the improvement program.
Right. In fact, Mr. Keene, if you look at the current six-year program, and particularly the last 3 years of it, it's virtually all bridge replacement. They're lumpy, and they are construction projects under federal and state rules, so they don't show up in this.
Mm-hmm. For what you would buy with this other this investment for other assets would be providing much-needed funding for the ongoing rehabilitation work in the Hampton Roads Bridge tunnels, which are more than 50 years old, many of them. They need new lighting systems. They need improvements to their ventilation systems. Fire life and safety systems, we've identified over $30 million that's needed just in these 2 years, each of the next 2 years in the Hampton Roads area for the tunnels. We also have hundreds of message boards and cameras and intersection signal equipment, movable bridge components that all need replacing. The one thing that really is staggering when you get this report is you'll just see the hundreds and thousands of items that we have when you start talking about maintaining every stripe on the road, every pavement marker, all the signs. Some of the numbers are really staggering. We have 125,000 lane miles of pavements. You know, we often talk about the 57,000-mile system, but it really is 125,000 miles of pavements. And in this slide, it shows that we just have the most recent information about pavements. So this includes the condition of pavements that were repaired, replaced, worked on, through December of 31st of 2008. So this is very, very new data that's just come in the last couple of months.
Help me understand the difference between 125,000 and 65,000.
If you took Interstate 95, where it's three lanes wide, and you counted every lane mile. It's 125,000 lane miles. So if I can just hold on just one second.
So
we have about 5,400 lane miles on the interstate, about 22,000 lane miles on the primary, and over 90,000 miles on the secondary. 79,000 miles are paved, 19,000 miles are not paved.
Could you repeat that again?
So on the interstate we have 5,300, almost 5,400 lane miles. On the primary we have almost 22,000 miles. Paved secondary is 79,000. Unpaved secondary is 19,000. And then there's some frontage roads and some other little roads that we have that add up to the 125,756 lane miles. So when we start talking about this little slide, It's awfully simple looking. We set our target about 4 years ago when we actually were maintaining interstate and primary pavements at 18%. And in 07, we were almost holding that on the interstate. The primary had already started to slip. In 08, you can see where we went. In 09, we actually had a small improvement in interstate pavement condition by 0.4%. And the primary by 0.1%. So at least it's not continuing to decline. That's good. However, on the secondary system, we've dropped to 31.1%. So when you start looking at how many deficient lane miles those are, if you project that out, it's probably close to 20,000 lane miles if the system is over 90,000 miles. For the interstate, this is 1,000 miles of deficient pavement, lane miles of pavement, and over 5,000 lane miles of bad pavement on the primary. So these are some significant challenges given the current funding situation. And so this next slide just talks a little bit about the reasons pavements have deteriorated is that unit prices of asphalt has increased significantly. So today we're only able to do about 33%. We're doing 33% less than we did 4 or 5 years ago because of the price of asphalt. And we also have competing needs for assets and today in terms of trying to manage the funds that we have. We have seen the needs in the tunnels go up as we've done more engineering analysis and have identified what those industrial systems need in order to be rehabilitated and maintained. And then the needs assessment also went up because of all the technology assets and other assets and inventories that we were able to complete, and the unit cost for those units going up. So in summary, I have some good news and some bad news. So the good news includes that interstate and primary pavements are at least staying at their current level or had a very slight upward tick. Bridges continue pretty much at their same level of performance, and if we continue to make major progress on addressing those bridges that need to be rebuilt, we'll be able to hold that. The good news in the asphalt industry is that prices are only expected to increase very slightly over the next couple of years. So unless we have some new economic change in energy prices, things should be relatively steady. And yesterday there was a report of some slight upward trend in the economy, so there was a little glimmer of hope out there on the federal report that actually retail sales might be up a tad. So that's all I could find in this report for the good news. The bad news is that we cannot meet our performance standards at current levels and the proposed levels that are in the six-year plan currently, that we will not be able to sustain pavement conditions without a major increase in funding in that area, and that service levels, I think, may hold their own, but I'm not willing to bet my next paycheck on that. Service levels also make me pretty nervous because one good hurricane and a couple of good snowstorms, and there could be some radical changes in how we finish out, how we're able to finish out a year, and what kind of service we're able to give. So there is only a finite amount of federal funds that can be used in the maintenance and operations program, because mostly it can only be spent on federally eligible roads. So even if we are able to move more federal dollars into the program, it's not going to be able to pave most of those secondary miles which are not on the federal aid system. And so, you know, without some additional funding, secondary pavements are going to continue to decline. And as my colleague Rita Buescher talked about earlier, We are looking at some additional revenue reductions in this fiscal year of $135 million, and another revenue forecast is due in November. So on that cheery note, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any additional questions for Ms. Ruff? If not, thank you. Connie, I want to thank you and your staff. I know this is not a trivial undertaking when you are collecting data that comes due in May and a report that's due in September. I was going to bring over a little visual aid for you of the annual reports that we produce for the General Assembly under code requirements. It's a fairly impressive stack, and it is absolutely fascinating reading. But these people do produce quite a bit of analytical information in a very short period of time.
I would like to, before we close, give some special recognition to the staff from the operations planning support group that for me, and to really all the people out in the field and the other divisions. There are enormous databases and spreadsheets that these people have been manipulating and getting in data and updating things in order to make this report. But the people who really put all this last part together include Rob Hansen, who's the division administrator, and Dr. Jeff Price, who's the assistant, and Laurie Henley, Jason DiNatale, Tiffany Avendanza, and Wenling Chin, who are all sitting here, you guys. Thank you all so very much for the tremendous job you've done.
Chairman, I have one thought. Is there any way that this data, as the deficiencies increase, see how it impacts traffic accidents and fatalities? I mean, do we do any study to show as things, how it's going to impact?
We do know some of those things today. So, for example, for every minute that is delayed in a crash, it takes approximately 4 minutes to for traffic to return to normal. So if you have a 10-minute delay in the tunnel on Hampton Roads, it takes 40 minutes to clear it, unless you have some intervention in terms of some kind of safety service patrol or something. But there are other things that, you know, the pavements, as pavements get worse and as congestion increases.
I'm trying to put it in human terms. Yeah. I mean, that's, I'm getting to, not me being inconvenienced, but is it going to result in more accidents and deaths?
That's a hard question to answer, and one that we tend, my view, to stay away from. As Mr. Davis reported yesterday, fatalities are down and crashes are down from over the last two-year trend, even while pavements are deteriorating. So all of a sudden you get into a pretty speculative.
Just not having good pavement markings on pavements is also...
That's why we're looking at the services side. We know that there are contributions that get made, but you'll hear us being...
Yeah, it's very difficult.
Careful about that. Yeah. Other questions? Mr. Coonley.
Mr. Sorrell, on your last slide here, is this the first time you actually will make this statement, asset conditions cannot meet performance standards at current or proposed funding levels?
Yes. In 2007, we were only about maybe $150 million between what was our budget and what the needs assessment said for FY10. And at that time, the contribution that was made through the six-year construction program gave us a little lift. Not a lot, but a little. But that's gone.
A pretty direct statement.
Correct. As you know, the board made a hard decision in adopting the fiscal year 10 budget to allocate additional resources to the $441 million level for pavements on the interstates and primaries in order to achieve those targets that are out there in fiscal year 11 and 13. So those are hard choices.
The one thing I would say about the pavement estimate is that we did include the benefit of the ARRA projects on pavements. And we did include the budget number of over $440 million that we were expecting to spend this fiscal year and through the next construction season. So you know, the unknown question there. And so these needs are based on that money being spent. So if this fiscal year budget in that arena gets cut, then it just means there's the gap's a little bigger.
Are those numbers available for absent the ARRA payments? I mean, it seems to me that where we ultimately ought to be looking, because that's very short-term money, is the trend in terms of what has actually been brought in from the state revenues or the normal, including federal revenues.
Ms. Pandek, yes, that data is available and is a part of an ongoing series, so we can provide that data.
Mm-hmm. So, so
other questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Sorrell. The chairman has delegated to the vice chair the ability to give you a short break.
Which you need after all this cheering in.
Before we launch into the next items on the workshop agenda, let's take a break till about 10 after 11. We'll stand in recess till then. All right, you're allowed to leave because they come in. Otherwise, I would be I'm going to make a motion we adopt my map.
Transportation Board meeting that has some chance today, but I'm just done this all the afternoon. I can give you a call back here and there. I hope so. It'll probably be after 2, and I'll be driving back, so I have plenty of time to give you a call once I'm there. Okay, I'll call you then. Thank you.
So Jim Hoover.
Starker statements will finally up. But you're right, it's but he's doing it in a stylistic manner.
Well, he's supposed to be Shakespeare. Yeah, he was a great punter, too.
Yeah, that's right. Well, my dad used to do that all the time.
He was a preacher.
Yeah. But he loved
the punting preacher.
He loved punting. And he loved what they used to call... Is it Swiftisms or Swiftisms?
Well, I don't know if we're...
Hello, how are you doing?
He said something darkly as he turned out the light. You know, that kind of little... And he could just do that off the top of his head. Of course, he didn't do that. Yeah, it would have been pretty entertaining.
I also have an email from you.
I didn't say hello to Mary Lee.
That's okay.
Yeah.
And it's here, but when that organization changes, all of a sudden it's a
Well, it's going to be an interesting time. It's going to be an interesting time down there.
It will be, but it's going to come back to this body right here.
I'm just trying to keep them all down there. Look.
If the workshop ends, well, let's see how it goes. This business meeting we probably couldn't be either.
We signed this right now.
You know, the secretary doesn't have to tap that hard to get your attention. All right, let's reconvene on the workshop agenda, and we'll pick up with item 5, Industrial Rail Access Project. Welcome, Mr. Page.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the board. Today, in the process that we do follow with our rail access project applications, we're briefing the board this month in the workshop, and then next month we will ask the board to take action on the recommendation of the department. Today's overview is of the application presented by SROC Cement Corporation. The facility will be located in Hanover County. One of the items that we do like to point out with our rail industrial access projects is that with this site, this is an adaptive reuse of an existing old lumber company. So it's a former industrial site that we're making a good reuse of in this cooperative and collaborative relationship that we're talking about today. With this location, it will also be on the Buckingham Branch Railroad, which is one of the short line railroads that this board funds annually through the Rail Preservation Fund. And this is exactly what that program is all about, the continuation of rail service and the growth and economic development of localities. SROC Cement Corporation has 11 production facilities in the United States. The closest that they have right now is in Frederick, Maryland, and also up in Martinsburg, West Virginia. Today, currently, that material is trucked to the area with the construction of 1,150 feet of track and the development of this facility. SROC Cement Company proposes to put in a distribution facility where rail will be used as the mechanism to transport their raw materials and cement to this facility. The project is also supported by the Virginia Economic Development Partnership and a letter of endorsement as well from the Buckingham Branch Railroad. The local capital and private investment of this facility will be $3.1 million. And again, this is a distribution center facility that will generate 4 jobs. Those are the direct jobs, just for the board's reference. Also, there are also scaled down jobs as well for the trucking industry and also for the quarries and sand pits that are in the area that will also be used as materials for the cement. Rail access will enable 310 annual rail car shipments a year off of Virginia's highways. We tend to look at that in this type of industry as a 4-to-1 split, so 4 trucks for every 1 rail car will be off the road. This is the project scoring criteria. Just as reference to the board, I won't go through it. This project scored fair of 61 out of 100 points. Just for the board's reference, any score that is below 50 points does not come forward with a recommendation of the department. This project is recommended by Director Badger through this presentation as well as the request for the action of the board next month for SROC Cement to receive an allocation of the Commonwealth Transportation Board of $325,625. The board may recall that this program is a $300,000 cap at 100% eligibility, and then there's a matched amount that the private industry has to put forward, which will be $25,625 because it's over the $300,000 level. And again, we'll be coming back to you next month with an action item. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn the floor back over to you for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Page? Mr. Schwartz.
Kevin, how does this score of 61
compare to others that we have approved over the last year?
It's very good, actually. Usually we're in the 50 to 60 range. Our scoring criteria is pretty well defined. To talk more about the expansion in economic development, our scoring criteria was last updated by this board about 12, 14 years ago. We've had a change in the program where we actually provide a higher level of funding. So the scoring as an aggregate came down, but we're still above the 50 score line. So 61 is actually a pretty good score for us for a facility of this size.
Are we at a point where we should be thinking about revisiting the scoring? Are you suggesting that?
We may, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I think Director Badger and I have had discussions about this program based on the action taken by the board on the road enhancement industrial access program as well. So we'll probably be coming back to this board in the fall after we get the ERA application process through. And thank you for this question because it does bode well to the transition into this topic. We will be coming back to the board probably in the fall of this year through Mr. Badger with some suggested recommendations and updates to the program.
Just one other question, if I may. What's the budget for this program?
We share $5.5 million of the Industrial Road and Airport Access Fund. So rail is a component of the other pieces that comes through Mike Estes's shop.
Right. And what's the amount that typically goes to rail?
Anywhere typically from about $1.5 to $2.5 million per year. We've had good years that have been greater than that.
Five or six.
Yes, sir. We've done as many as 18 projects. We set a record at 18.
Thank you so much.
Yes, sir.
Other questions for Mr. Page? Page, as usual, an excellent presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Always wanted to figure out how to go as quickly as you did.
You have to talk really
fast. Next on the agenda is the enhancement program proposals. Mr. Estes from our local assistance division is here to present. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. I want to I'll go through this fairly quickly, like you said, Mr. Chairman, probably not as quickly as Mr. Page, but what I'll try to do is quickly kind of revisit what we have already talked about in the past. And before I do that, I do think I owe you a few seconds to thank you for taking the time with me and my staff over the past couple of months to work through these proposals. Obviously means I know you guys are very busy, but I do appreciate you taking the time and out of your busy schedule to help us kind of formulate what I think will be a better program in the long run. And as I was talking with Mr. Coulomb at the break, I think you'll see here in a minute, as we had a lot of debate back in June, that we've landed at a pretty good spot, or you'll see through the survey that we talked about, there is a great deal of consensus with the board as to where I think we should take the program. But, of course, that's what we're here for today, is to hear some additional feedback from you to see if we are heading in the right direction. I always want to revisit kind of what the enhancement program is for those who haven't dealt with it as long as some of the others on the board. And always, the takeaway from this slide for me is always when folks are talking to you about as we make revenue reductions and so forth, with the department, that this is a mandatory 10% set aside by federal law. So the state has to spend this money on this type of program. I won't go into the detail, but you all are well aware of the number of applications and the popularity of this program every year. We receive anywhere from 150 to 200 applications. I think last year they asked for like $65 million worth of funding, where we have $15 to $20 million to allocate every year. This is kind of what I would, we went through again in June. This is what I would sum up as the problem statement of why I'm bringing this proposal to the board. Basically, I would say the takeaway from this point, or from this slide, is the fact that we've delivered about half of our projects that are out there right now since 1993, the allocations that have gone out under the enhancement program. And we lag considerably behind other states in our reimbursement rate, which is an indicator of our ability to deliver these projects. So that's really our problem what I would like for us to focus in on is the desire to complete more projects, get some of these existing projects that are on the books off the books, and move the program forward.
Mr. Chairman, go ahead.
Mr. Keene and then Mr. Bowie.
A question on why we might lag other states. Can you tell me how many are, I guess a better question would be, on some of the slow payouts, is the result of the counties being having a fully funded project and not carrying it out? Or is it a project that's not funded that is laying there waiting for additional funds to be awarded? And the second part of that is, since we do this incrementally, can't they begin the project before they awarded the
service? Mr. Chairman, Mr. King, great question. I think the problem is probably both of those. In many instances, we have smaller local governments who don't have experience delivering federally funded projects, so there's somewhat of a challenge for them to deliver that project in an expeditious manner. So as I think everyone here knows, you know, we spend a lot of time with those localities trying to work them through that process. On the second end, and one of the things we'll talk about, is the board had made good strides on trying to provide additional funding to those projects. You know, right now the board policy states we have to fund at least 25% of a request. But even with that, that could take, if we get 25% every year over 4 years and they're relying wholly on the enhancement dollars, that lags behind the ability to complete that. So a lot of those projects are partially funded and are still waiting for full funding to bring to completion. Obviously, we can get those projects started on preliminary engineering and project development, but a majority of the costs are going to be associated with the actual contract, with the construction project itself. So there's a combination, Mr. Keene, of both of those out there.
Mr. Bowie.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Estes, trying to clean up these 300 and some projects that are in development, would it be worthwhile for your organization to send the board members lists of stale projects in our districts that we could look into? I became aware of one in the last week or two where the project had been canceled a couple of years, but they hadn't bothered to report to you that fund could be reallocated.
Sure.
If that would be of help, I for one would be glad to take a look at the ones in my district.
Right.
If you could furnish a list of the stale projects.
We will do that. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bowie, I think that was a wonderful point and very timely. I was just talking to Ms. Pandak about that at the break as well. I just shared her a list of what we had put together and what staff had put together in Northern Virginia District with all projects since 1993 that have received allocations. And it is our intent to provide that. I told her it was in somewhat rough format, but it is our intent to provide that to all the board members for your districts, or if you're a statewide board member for the state, if you'd like that, to show that. And in that list, you know, it was very apparent, you know, projects that had received money in the 90s that hadn't had as much expenditure or progress as we'd like, very evident for the board member to see. One of the things I'll go back to as well is one of the things we talked about in June was the department's deallocation process that we've done over the last couple of years. We've reviewed over 600 projects across the state to look at that activity and sent out letters. Many of you have been copied or participated with us on those discussions with those applicants, and we'll continue to be very aggressive with that, because I do see that as a big part of what this is, a multifaceted solution to this issue. As Mr. Keene said, it's not just one aspect that we can fix. It's a lot of different things that are going on, and I think that's an excellent point of something that we're going to continue to put additional focus on. So with our thought was, as we refine those lists, when the applications are coming in for FY11, which are due in December 1st, that we would provide the board with a copy of everything in your district, the history of the enhancement program at that time. And that's what our goal has been, Mr. Bowie, to get that to you at that time.
Thanks.
Okay, so we'll move on to our proposal. This slide is, again, the same overall proposal that we had in June, but you'll see, again, the mix of what our recommendations has shifted based on your feedback from June. Again, it is a focus on completing the existing projects. There are a lot of great projects out there that we just want to help put some energy into and focus on to get those done. We do think that as we continue to move forward, when we talk about new applications in the future, that it would be a good idea to consider core transportation function, that the board consider that as a requirement for new applications. We'll talk about that in a minute. And just simply modify the policy, the overall board policy, to better enable projects to get to completion. Again, we had a very very good dialogue back in June on the proposal, and we kind of landed with a survey of the board members to make sure we were heading in the direction you wanted us to head. And again, I took the time at the beginning to thank you, because I think we've got a survey from everyone in here, or we've talked to everyone in here, or I think I personally have talked to almost everyone on the board about the proposal. So I thank you for your time with that. And what I want to do is very quickly, Mr. Chairman, go through the survey. I think it was a total of 8 questions. And using that wonderful name, SurveyMonkey, we solicited some information from you. And quickly, the tool gives us a snapshot of your response. The first thing was, do you think that we can strengthen the policy? We had complete consensus on that there is some room for improvement. This minimum allocation of 50%, again, I mentioned that current policy by the board is to allocate at least 25% of a request. You can see that about 67% said that they agreed with that as being a good proposal. One of the things I'll note on your handout, where it says other comments on kind of the bottom right or middle to the right, that's where you as board members have provided some additional feedback in writing on those questions. It's not additional input. And I just pull a quote from one of the board members. It basically said 50% funding minimum. Get in, get done, was kind of the feedback that we got back from someone from the board. As we move on, another proposal that we discussed that we think at staff would have a large impact would be if you get a small project that comes in, under $200,000, and instead of applying a 25% rule or a 50% rule, if you as a board, determine that's a good project, then we would recommend that we go ahead and fund that fully for these small projects, and again, to get those projects done. That way, there's not a lag in the project development getting into construction.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Wright.
Mike, I wasn't here for the discussion that was held, I guess it was in June, wasn't it?
June, yes, sir.
Under this recommendation here, and I support it, that a project that's a good project and it's $200,000 or less that should be fully funded. And I know in the workshops, the staff has constantly told localities, the smaller your request, the more likely that you're going to get it. But what I run into all the time, and probably other representatives of districts have the same problem, I might have 4 or 5 requests for $1 million.
Yes, sir.
And you only have $1.2 million to distribute. And there's a $200,000, project that maybe is 5th or 6th in line in terms of the points. Did you all discuss that at all, or how you would deal with that?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. White, that's a difficult issue. We did discuss that a great deal, and we simply thought that if it made kind of the final list, or it scored highly and things like that and was legitimate, that this would go a long way to getting projects funded. And we do try to encourage folks to come in with reasonable requests, dollar amounts and so forth. But I do agree, as costs of projects have gone up and people have been more aggressive with how large the scope is, they've come with some large requests. Kind of a different element, I don't know if I'm answering the question, different element to this is some of our challenge will be, as we do the outreach from here forward, is some of those larger projects we've said we'll try to break those into phases or break those into segments, and maybe they'll be better to be funded that way. We also have to make sure that those phases are standalone projects. So if you get a $200,000 phase project, that it can be built on its own. I know it's a little different than angle than what your question is, but I do think the bottom line is what I think I heard loud and clear in June was that the board still wanted independent discretion as each one of you as members over your selections. And with what we've done with this proposal, we've tried to ensure that that still takes place. We've tried to provide a little bit of a box to work within based on the issue that we see at hand, but we've tried to keep the independent board selection or the selection by each independent board member in its entirety. So as you know, when we work through the selections every year, we work with you individually from our staff perspective, and staff can help kind of evaluate your top 6 and what that does from the request versus the money you have available.
Thank you.
Short.
Mike, just to put the $200,000 in context, given all the budgetary issues that we're dealing with, at this point, what do you anticipate is going to be the available revenue to allocate for this for the next round? Do you think it's likely to be maintained about where it was, or do you think it's likely to be significantly different?
I'm looking to Mr. Lawson to see if he has any idea on the federal revenue side. Do you know if they've even gotten close to that, John, on looking at?
We're expecting
the same. Just if those didn't hear that, John was just saying we anticipate the federal revenue stream to stay about the same level, and with that 10%, it's
10% is mandated.
10% is mandated. So we've seen some years, depending on rescission and other things, it fluctuate a great deal. I usually tell the board members it's between 15 to 20 million. And that's kind of a little bit of a swag number. But I will say last year alone, I forget the exact number, but we brought in, I want to say, a couple to $3 million from our deallocation process. We've looked at old projects and brought those back, and many of you know that, looking at some of the old projects. So with that, there's a little bit of additional money that comes in, and hopefully we'll continue as we try to, again, more aggressively look at old projects.
Thank you.
Sure. All right. Quickly moving through, 91% of the response to the survey did encourage us to look at limiting future project selections when we're looking at new projects again, and we'll talk about when we might do that, to those core transportation functions that we talked about a minute ago. This was one that I would say the board obviously had consensus on as well, but in the other direction. Didn't want to talk about having a two-year application cycle, and we appreciate that. And just pulling again, one of the quotes from the additional comments was thought it was important for communities to be able to get their projects in front of the CTB on an annual basis. So we will not fool with the two-year application cycle in our recommendations. I was pleased with the board encouraging staff to look at potentially holding off any new projects for 1 year to try to address the issue with the existing projects. 73% said that they would be okay with limiting applications to existing projects only for a year, but it was very clear that for majority of the feedback, this should be a one-time fix. I heard that very loud and clear. Just quickly, one of the last question that we had in the survey was trying to look at effectiveness in case we had didn't have general consensus. I think we had general consensus on a lot of our proposals, and so I won't spend a lot of time on that, but the first one is just really quickly the 25 to 50%. Moving that from the minimum allocation. Six of the nine folks who responded to that thought that was a very effective point. If you look at limiting the categories, eight of the 11 folks who responded to that thought that was either very effective or effective as a proposal. As well as that $200,000 issue we just talked about, eight of the 10 board members who responded to that thought that would be a very effective tool to employ. One of the proposals that was on the effectiveness chart that wasn't an individual question was looking at potentially increasing that $200,000 level to $500,000. And that was a little bit all over the board on what the reaction was to that. Some felt about five of the 11 thought that was effective, and another half thought maybe that wouldn't be such a good idea. We'll keep that on our radar for potential discussion in the future. All right, to sum up, staff's recommendations, we're going to recommend some changes in a phased approach, so I'll try to go for that quickly. For this current application cycle, where applications are due in December, that would be for FY11, so awards in June of 2010, money available beginning of the federal fiscal year in October of 2010. We would propose increasing the minimum allocation for applications from the 25% to the 50%. And to fully fund any project selected, again, at the discretion of the individual board members, that would be estimated to cost $200,000 or less. We would then go on to the subsequent fiscal years, because we do feel like we need, if we're going to have substantial change on what we're asking for applications and so forth, that we need to give time for outreach on that. Additional proposal for the subsequent year would be to limit the applications, as one of our recommendations, to existing projects only for a year. And we would communicate that out accordingly. And then, after that, when we start accepting new applications again, apply the criteria to core transportation functions. So, again, we're looking at this over a three fiscal year phase out of this recommendation. one of the most important things we want to make.
Sorry, Mr. White.
The last bullet there on 14.
Yes, sir. You have a different slide in front of you. I took off the $500,000 point.
No, it's still on ours. Okay.
Still on yours. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. White, for catching that. I changed that on Carol this morning, first thing. We were discussing that and just felt with the survey response on that that we weren't going to formally move that forward as a proposal at this time.
So that's not a part of your recommendation?
No, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Short.
Mike, just a clarification. So you're saying for the 1 year, limiting applications for existing projects only for 1 year, that wouldn't be this round. That would be the subsequent round.
Right? Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman Schwartz. We've already gone out, as you know, and done our outreach. We've already done the applicant workshops that we do. So we've already gone out and communicated what this application round is going to entail. We didn't think it would be fair to just cut that off and not accept proposed new projects this year. That would be for next year only.
Fair enough.
And that would give us opportunity in the spring to have that communication outreach through our workshops as well to make sure those applicants all know what's going on.
And just refresh my memory in the other, in other words, by limiting it to these four core things, what's dropping out basically?
Very key point for the board to pick up on because you will get phone calls on this, Mr. Chairman Schwartz. What we are proposing with this is if you look at core transportation function, it's the bike ped function, it's the streetscape, corridor improvement type projects. It is not the visitor centers, the historic preservation, the depots, the acquisition of scenic easements and things like that, or historic easements. Part of what we're talking about here in a second is the outreach factor. So I would expect that we will hear both positive feedback from more of the bicycle pedestrian community and then some concerns from others from the historic preservation side of the fence on this.
Mr. Coolman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mike, in point number three there, what does corridors mean when you say along corridors? Does that somehow correlate with our discussion of corridors yesterday, or is that...
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Coolman, that's a much more generic term, not a corridor in any way of VTRAN's discussion. It's basically a linear corridor, and depending on the size of the town or the community, it could be quite extensive or quite small.
Right.
All right.
Excuse me. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Keene.
What's the rationale of eliminating a specific item like visitor centers? It appears to me to be somewhat tied to as a core transportation type of program.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Keene, we just, to be blunt, the simple rationale was with the revenue reduction on, you know, secondary, urban, other projects, we thought it was prudent to try to focus the money that we still had available down to the local level on things that enhance core transportation movement of bodies, whether it's pedestrian, bicycles, or enhancing through safety or beautification those corridors of travel. So it was really centered around travel and moving the people through the community. We thought it was, again, prudent to take that focus. And a lot of it was based on the work that we had done with the board on the stimulus projects, on the enhancement projects, so trying to focus that money again on the pedestrian bicycle improvements. So that was the genesis of that, sir.
Mr. Coolman.
Mr. Chairman. Mike, how long has this enhancement program been in place?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Coolman, I believe the board first awarded allocations in 1993.
The reason I'm asking that, and I'm going to make an observation here, and I want to make it the observation in a non-threatening way, is lots of things have changed since 1993. I just want you, my colleagues, to be aware that at the moment, the Northern Virginia District population that's represented is about the same as five other districts here combined. And that's one of the phenomena that's happened over the last 16 or 20 years is the population growth. I know that we have a certain comity here on the board about equal allocations of these monies by member. But what I just wanted to mention to you is over time that becomes probably less desirable given the population differences. It's one reason that I discussed a couple of months ago the idea of combining districts to try to make our districts more equal in terms of the people that we represent and the regions that we're actually trying to serve. I'm just going to suggest that the allocation of money by member may serve the interests of the board here, but I don't think it's the best allocation of funds to serve Virginians. So I'm going to have it on my agenda over the next couple of years to really try to suggest some additional reform in this area that would let us achieve a little more equity in the way that these funds are currently going to be allocated. I would just say this. This is going to be one of our biggest discussions that we have going forward as we change as a board. And we are doing it in a pretty tough situation. Several years ago, we did a poll that included this transportation question. It said, do you disagree or agree with this statement? My region gets back as much transportation dollars as I send to Richmond in transportation taxes. And statewide, only 14% of Virginians agreed with that statement. So there's a fundamental distrust of the system that now goes on that people get back the money they pay. And some of that's fact-based, but most of it's just comes with not having enough money to go around. But I will tell you this, the one criticism I get of the CTB more often than any other in Northern Virginia relates directly to this program, that somehow our region with, as I said, as many people as five other districts combined somehow only gets the same amount of money as everyone else. So I'm not saying this in a threatening manner, but I do suggest that we're going to have to look at this as a future reform and probably as a discussion that's going to encompass a lot of other of our resource allocations as well.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I agree with Mr. Coulmay in one respect. I spend more time on enhancement grant applications than virtually anything else in my district. And it represents peanuts when you think about the amount of money that we actually deal with on a global basis and what's needed. But I would also add that even though there is an equal share for each district, there's also a statewide pie that all of the at-large members of the board administer and decide where that money is going. And so there is a mechanism already to deal with some of the inequities you perceive and some of your constituents perceive. I guess I would also say that that even though my district only gets roughly $1.2 million, somewhere in the range, $1.25 million, the southern half of my district is fairly poor. And so a $200,000 grant on a small project in County X can go a long way to improving the life of that community and to bring an enhancement to the value of what they experience every day. So I would be opposed to changing the equal share to each district member, but I'm also very supportive of the large pool that goes to the at-large members for distribution around the state to deal with some of the things you're discussing.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. White has already addressed my issue with that, but before those remarks came up, I just did not want to assume. I want to verify that pedestrian and bicycle facilities do include greenways.
Absolutely, Mr. Martin. Yes, sir.
Just as a quick observation, When the world changed in 1992 with the completion of the interstate system as declared by Congress and the opening of the T era, which is when all these programs started, I can tell you that across the nation in all the states I've worked in, your observation about the amount of enthusiasm for what is, by all aspects, a fairly minor program is shared by all your peers in other states. They are the most contentious and fought over projects in any state that I've worked in. And as Mr. Estes has illustrated, become the hardest ones to complete. It is easier to do the Woodrow Wilson Bridge than it is an enhancement project. But your observations are absolutely on target. Is in that global sense, as we move forward, the whole issue of fair share and what you pay is what you should get back is what's emerged since 92, and it is the issue of 2010. Excuse me for editorializing. Please continue.
You're right on. My staff in the back of the room appreciate the comparison to Woodrow Wilson Bridge as well. We do spend quite a lot of time and effort on these projects, and I think with good results at the end of the day, regardless. Mr. Chairman, just moving on, knowing this is important to a lot of people, even though it may not be a lot of dollars, we want to make sure we've spent the time over the past few months to get to this point. We propose spending over the next 30 days soliciting some feedback through our normal avenues, but also with some of the special interest groups that Mr. Schwartz helped me bring up on targeting those folks who are going to be both for that, again, like in the bicycle pedestrian ring. We want them to weigh in, but also those who are going to have some concerns with some of these proposals. And I do think that you're going to hear that as well over the next 30 days. And I would just simply ask that you, as you all already do, just continue to keep us in the loop on what you're hearing so we can bring that back to the board in a subsequent meeting. So this is our proposal right now.
Two questions I have. First of all, the narrowing of the scope of the program will not enhance the expenditure problem that you have as far as controlling. That's not going to help solve that problem. So we're really narrowing the program and taking out some people who have qualified previously that may not. We're going to have some projects in there that we're expecting to get phase two allocations that now we're not qualified. We may end up with a project that's halfway complete. Now how are we going to address that?
Great point, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Keene, one of the things that I was hinting at earlier about our challenge over the next few months will be our real true definition of an existing project, you know, what will stay grandfathered in, per se, Mr. Keene will say, to make sure that we don't have projects out there that are left in limbo, and also to work forward on making sure that when we define what's an eligible application, that we are talking about a standalone project. So if there are changes in the future or things that are modified, that if a locality comes to you and asks for $200,000, they can actually produce something for that $200,000. Or if you award to them $500,000, they can actually give you something with that $500,000. Too often, and some with our encouragement of trying to phase things out, localities have assumed that they're going to get allocations year after year after year to kind of click away at a project that they have. So I do think that's something that we're going to have to do a lot of work on over the next few months.
Mr. Chairman, the other item I wanted to ask you would be any other categories of obstacles that we might be facing as far as being able to distribute the funds would be once that a project has been approved with the broad requirement qualifications that's laid out and still find out after award or after the acceptance that it doesn't qualify. What are we limited on our ability to vet these projects to the extent that we're pretty sure that we're going to be able to follow through with? One, for example, is the Jewel Valley. It's in the Bristol district. We're looking at probably a $700,000 award there over a period of time, and now we've determined they don't own the right-of-way, or the right-of-way doesn't – the project doesn't qualify because of right-of-way issues.
Right.
It appeared to me that we ought to have known that before we get to the point where it's laid there for 3 years
And that's part of the problem. You know, they would build, and we have awarded. So, are we limited there, or what is our process of vetting these projects to make sure that? And do we have other projects in a similar situation?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Keene, I'll try to take a crack at that. Every time we get it, every year we get applications. You know, we get say 150 to 200 applications. We do look through the scope of the applicants that proposed and work with Federal Highway on eligibility. And at the highest level, at a broad-based look, all we can do with, you know, 150 to 200 applications. And each year when we come to the board, we'll provide you a list of projects that have been deemed ineligible and don't even make it to you for consideration. So that's our first stop for eligibility. And then when we get into projects, to be blunt, a lot of times when we get into projects where we're scoping them out, there have been assumptions that the applicant have made that maybe don't come to fruition, like a right-of-way issue where they've assumed that they're going to get right-of-way donated or right-of-way that's going to be in a different ownership, but then at the end of the day, they haven't been able to get to that point. So some of that has to work itself out through the projects. I do think, going back to the commissioner's point, with these unique projects, we're going to run into those on occasion, regardless of what we do as a policy board to change that. I don't know if we're ever going to get away from that. I'm tired. Okay, moving on to next steps. Our goal, again, would be through the month of October, over the next 30 days from here, to solicit that feedback. We're going to put this proposal up on our webpage as well and ask folks to put in feedback to us and to you, I'm sure, and then come back to the board in November with a workshop presentation on what we heard from that. And depending on what we hear, we may ask the board for action that same month, or we may have to have a continued discussion based on what we hear and have action maybe the subsequent month or something to that. Again, we're kind of putting that up to what we hear over the next 30 days. And just a reminder again that the application deadline that for the current cycle is coming up on December 1st. I think that's an important date for you to be aware of as well. So with that, I know this is a difficult topic and a tough one, but I again truly appreciate the support from the board to at least have the dialogue. Wherever we land, I think we're going to have a stronger program because of it. And again, I appreciate that. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it back to you.
Any final questions for Mr. Estes? Mike, I'd like to acknowledge the fact that, you know, for the last 3 years, we've installed a 14 PowerPoint rule. And generally, the staff does an excellent job, and I want you to note that over the last 2 days, you've seen the next enhancement in PowerPoints when he's starting to do animation. As you've noticed the little circles coming in on these slides, we may have to modify our rules about that.
Thank you, sir. I was a little worried that you were going to highlight that I had gone over the limit of the number of slides.
Great job, Mike. Let's see. And since you're doing such a great job, let's continue on with the revenue sharing and item 7.
I usually make the mistake of saying the next one's a much shorter topic, but I should never say that. Revenue sharing, really quickly. The intent of this presentation today is simply to update the board on the applications that we received recently on the revenue sharing program for FY10, current fiscal year. Again, for those who may not be as familiar with the revenue sharing, just a little bit of background. Again, it's a 50-50 program. It's a matching program where basically the state puts up a dollar matched by a locality's dollar. It's open to all counties and the independent cities and towns. Let's say 81 that are in the urban system, and the maximum allocation that a locality can request is $1 million. I won't spend time on the tiered request, but we may have to get to that eventually. Just a reminder that there is priority set in law on how the money flows based on the four tiers that you see in front of you. Okay, quick overview. Again, where our staff is still reviewing all the applications, again, for similar to enhancement for eligibility issues from a state perspective. I just want to give you a snapshot of what we've gotten. 58 localities have submitted applications for 124 projects, requesting about $40 million of state funds. $40 million of state funds. And if you look at that compared to last year, and this is a little bit of a lot on the slide, but I'll walk through it very quickly. There's 176 eligible localities that can participate. That's the 95 counties and the 81 cities and towns. This year we've had the 58 request funding, down from 76 last year. And then you can see the breakdown between the towns, the cities, and the counties. And then we've also broken it down for the board just for information on the number of projects, again, down from 189 to 124, and the mix of whether it's locally administered or VDOT administered. Again, the requested amount of state funds is $40 million this year compared to $49 million last year. And there is a function where the locality can present that they have an unmatched amount, and that was one of the tiers, used to be priority one, that's moved down now. So you can see the local funds that aren't matched represent about $8.7 million this year, down from $24.5 million last year. So with that, that's the quick overview of where we stand. I will just kind of preempt a question that Mr. White had asked me yesterday about, you know, where do we stand with the program and our ability to fund it in FY10. I'll look and see if, barring the CFO not here and the chair, secretary here, I'll do my best with it. As you saw, the budget reductions for FY10 was state dollars. I think it was $130-some million for VDOT. This is one of the many pots of money that the secretary, the CFO, and the commissioner are evaluating. I don't know where we're going to land completely on that. Just as a reminder, the revenue sharing is somewhat made up of a mix of dollars. It's $50 million in state funds, $15 million of pure state dollars, and then $35 million from bond proceeds that were authorized under 3202. So that's adds a little bit of the complexity to the matter. So depending on where we land on the FY10 budget adjustments, our plan is to be ready to bring whatever we can to the board as soon as we can. Localities are waiting on this money. We'll be ready to bring it in October if we're ready at that time on the budget. If not, we'll bring it when we are. So that's where we are with revenue sharing.
Thanks. Any additional questions for Mike on the revenue sharing program? Not. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
We have one agenda item left for the workshop, so I'd like to complete the workshop item if we could, and then we'll take a short break, grab some lunch before we begin the business session. Welcome, Mr. Hofdriger, and the on-the-ground integration of land use and transportation is represented by permit regulations. This is my second most favorite topic, just in case you wanted to know.
Glad to hear that, Chairman. The first time when we brought this to you, I think most of the people that are on the board now weren't here then. So I'll be ready to answer whatever questions you have. Just let me go through this really quickly. I tried to keep this down to a very limited number of slides. Land use permits, basically if you do any kind of work on the state right-of-way and it's not VDOT doing the work and it's not just traveling, then you need a land use permit. That's a simple explanation for what it is. It's a part of the Virginia Administrative Code. It supports the general rules of the Commonwealth Transportation Board, and it covers things like utility installations, landscaping, entrances, surveying, parades, historical markers, basically anything that anyone else does on our right-of-way. The current regulations that we have were adopted in 1983. That's a long time for a set of regulations to still exist and not really be changed. We've been trying to do something with the regulations since 1992, and back in 2005, we got permission from the CTB to take these public hearing. Once again, they were adopted in 1983. A lot of things have changed since then. For instance, there's new technologies. Back in 1983, if you asked somebody about fiber optics, they'd say, oh, you mean those wonderful little lamps with all the funny colors? People weren't thinking about them in terms of communication and things being laid under the roads. There have been changes in federal law and state law, the Telecommunications Act, things like that. Changes in procedures and organization. The way the department was organized back in 1983 is completely different than it's organized now and that it's going to be organized next year. There have been increased costs, obviously. And really, the original version of the regulation was written more as a manual and not as a regulation. There was a lot of redundant text, and it was overly long. The update is controlled by the Administrative Process Act and Governor's Directive, which means there's a bunch of agency reviews that have to happen. We went through a public comment period that was held in summer of 2006. We had public hearings. We received 140 comments from about 50 people that submitted them. Most of them dealt with utilities, surveyors, and loggers. We made revisions to the document based upon those. We pulled out the whole section in the document that dealt with entrances, because that's now dealt with in all of our access management regulations. And the next steps for the effort are next month for you guys to say, yes, we can move ahead with it, to get the Office of Attorney General approval, Department of Planning and Budget approval, Secretary and Governor, and then we're done. Well, sort of. Then we have to do the implementation, get everyone trained on any changes and things like that. The elements, we have things that we call district-wide permits that cover utility service connections, logging entrances, which are temporary, and surveying activities. We have utility permits. We've made some changes in those based on the current regulations. Most of them, because we've worked very closely with the utility companies themselves to make sure that we got out there, worked for everybody. I mean, preserve transportation and allow them to operate effectively. We've done different changes in terms of some of the other permits. In terms of activities on the right-of-way, parades and races, you only need a permit if you're going to be blocking traffic or stopping a lane or something like that. For signs, one of the things that's not covered right now in the land use permit manual, but it is a separate policy the CTB passed, was the memorial markers, the ones where someone's killed on the highway, put up a little marker. CTB passed a policy on it back in, I guess it was 2003, and immediately after that, the General Assembly, in a budget item, passed language that basically nullified part of what the CTB passed. So what we've done is taken that, put it into the land use permit regulations, updated it to be consistent with the law, and fixed it that way. It also covers things like bus stop shelters. There are localities like Prince William and Fairfax that are putting bus stop shelters on our right-of-way, so it covers those things as well. Fees, we changed the fees. Obviously, things that cost what they did in 1983 don't cost that way now. As you can see, the fees have gone up, but really they haven't gone up quite as much as probably they should have, and that's because when we first wrote this change to the land use permit manual, that was back in 2004, this particular version. So we were going on what the costs were back then. We went through the public hearing process with these fees, and we felt that it wouldn't be fair to come back to people and say, hey, we told you it was going to be this much, and by the way, we're changing it to this other amount. So we're moving ahead with those fees as they were set. And that's it. If there are any questions?
Questions. Mr. Schwartz.
Where can we get the text of the regulations? The current text?
We have a copy of it on our external website. I'm trying to remember whether it has the most recent changes or not, but we will post the most recent one up there as soon as we get it finished being reviewed by Policy Division to make sure that we haven't had any weird spelling errors or weird things in terms of how it's laid out.
When do you think that will be?
Yeah. Or if you would like a copy immediately right now, I have one right here.
I'd love to have one if you have one. But otherwise, maybe you could just, when they're ready, just email them to all the...
We'll see that they get distributed.
Yeah. Did I understand that you will highlight the changes in that distribution?
One thing that we have to be careful of, this is a completely new regulation organized completely differently than the old one. So we don't really have a old regulation versus a new regulation with highlighted changes.
Correct.
What we do have on the registrar's website is sort of a summary of the different sections and general changes listed, but it's not like in line one it said this, and line two, does something different. We don't have that kind of version. The only lined-out version that we do have is versus the old draft change versus the new draft change. So if you want to see that, we can certainly get that to you.
Well, I think the advice we're getting is read it as a clean approach to how we do permit regulation. Ms. Bendix.
Mr. Chairman, with respect to the bus stop shelters, I have a vague recollection that there was significant frustration in the Prince William Road of Virginia area about locating and going through that whole permitting process. Can you tell me whether those issues are being resolved with this new regulation or...
Unfortunately, this particular regulation cannot resolve those issues. because if I remember correctly, those issues were mostly dealt with the building code end of the requirements.
Correct.
Which are administered by the Department of General Services and not VDOT.
Good recollection. I remember that myself. Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Hopper? As you can tell, this task is probably one of the more thankless tasks that goes on in government. And very frankly, I've watched the staff approach this with a high degree of professionalism as they've tried to work their way through it. The permit fee issues will not go away, and I'm sure they will be back very shortly, since these fees are a real bargain at the end of the day compared to what it costs to really process a fee as we move forward. Thank you, Mr. Hopriger. Appreciate that. It is about 10 after 12. Did you have a final question? What I'd like to do is recess the work session till 12:30 or upon the secretary's return, and give you the option of getting your lunches. So we'll stand in recess.